It's time for Lunch Hour Reviews.
Creatures who feast upon the flesh of their victims.
I paint his liver with some fava beans.
Soylent Green, nice made out of people.
Feeding time.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren, and we are the Rants Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of the Rants Macabre, please visit Fangoria.com.
So on this episode of Lunch Hour Reviews, we're going to talk about a few movies, some TV, and some graphic novels. So we have quite a well-rounded array of horror.
I'm excited. Okay, so I'm going to start us off with a newer movie. I think it's probably now on VOD. It'll be exciting when it comes to Netflix because more people will see it, but The Final Girls.
Welcome to Camp Bluefinch, where romance and the sun can turn deadly.
Best summer ever!
This is the summer that's gonna change your life.
Where the days are warm.
Hey, man, that guitar is choice.
Thanks, Blake. Bitch and hair.
The girls are cool.
Did I miss the kumbaya circle?
The nights are always hot. And evil lurks around every corner.
Gosh, you startled me.
So I just go down that path all the way?
A guy like you can go anywhere he wants.
And any moment, Billy can strike. They won't be singing Kumbaya. They'll be screaming Kumbano. Pack your bags for Camp Bloodbath.
You just messed with the wrong virgin.
Where the only marshmallow that will roast is your sanity.
Directed by Todd Strauss Schulson and written by M.A. Fortin and Joshua John Miller. So it gets its name from the horror trope of the final girl being the innocent, the last one who survives, you know, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween-style slasher movies. I guess even Sigourney Weaver in Alien might be considered a final girl in the first film.
She's like the final girl.
Final woman. But in this case, the story, I thought it was very cool. So quickly, the synopsis. A young woman grieving the loss of her mother, a famous scream queen from the 80s, finds herself pulled into the world of her mom's most famous movie. Reunited, the women must fight off the film's maniacal killer. So it's very cool that the idea for this meta horror movie was conceived and co-written by Joshua John Miller as a way of dealing with the death of his dad, Jason Miller, who starred as Father Karras in The Exorcist.
No way.
It was pretty cool.
Wow.
It's kind of fascinating that, like, you don't really think about it, but every actor who's, you know, made a pivotal movie and then gone on to have a family and have kids, like, that's like having your family albums in the public for regular viewing, and people get to chime in and tell you what they think about your dad. And
like, all the time, good or bad.
Yeah,
no matter
it's like,
what.
You're a stranger. Leave me alone.
Yeah, right.
You didn't know my dad. That was an actor.
Like, yeah, right. Yeah. He really wasn't a priest.
He didn't wind about that window. So starring Thaisa Farmiga. Is that how you say it? Thaisa?
I don't fucking know.
Thaisa Farmiga. Her character is Max. And by association, she's also kind of haunted by her mother being one of the original final girls.
Okay.
And the idea is her mother has a very hard time getting cast in anything else. So she kind of becomes this kind of bittered actress. She loves her daughter. She's not a bitter person, but she's just incredibly frustrated.
That is hard, I think, for actresses, though. Being in horror is a very, like, it's like the next step to porn.
Pigeonholed.
Yeah.
It means something else in porn. But in this case, so her mother's kind of...
It took me a second. It took me all those seconds. There was about four.
So her mother is kind of modeled on Alice from the original Friday the 13th, and the idea that that actress was legitimately stalked and threatened by a uber fan of that movie. So she didn't want to act anymore. It's really sad, but when it came time for making a sequel, she said, I don't want to be in it. And they're like, we'll kill you off and then roll credits. You got it. And so, I mean, she hasn't done a lot since, and she's kind of haunted by that that role. So that's kind of the character Max's B being similarly haunted by that memory. She's a little bitter, and then she gets roped into appearing at a double feature for her mother's movie, Camp Bloodbath. So it becomes fantastical, where there's a fire in the theater and they need to escape by cutting through the screen.
Of course, that's the only exit.
And I'm going sure. into the movie. Yeah, I mean, yeah. So yeah, so it is actually a pretty effective, like, mother-daughter bonding story in that her mother is in character the whole time she's in the movie. And it's kind of funny that, like, once her and her Scooby gang wind up inside the movie, that experience is on a 92-minute loop. So initially, they don't know where they are. They're in the woods. They get passed by a van that, like, is filled with the actors from the movie, and they're just like, what the fuck is going on? Who?
Right.
And then it's only when it happens again 92 minutes later that they recognize that, like, oh, we're in the movie. So they hitch a ride. They're having to navigate this scenario where everyone in the van is an archetype from an 80s slasher movie. So you've got, like, dumb jock, over-sexualized dummy. He's one of the actors from Workaholics.
Oh, I like Workaholics.
Me too. And so you've got the, like, oversexed teenage girl who's just looking for any opportunity to take off pieces of clothing
or
dance or whatever. And then you get her mom, who's supposed to be the innocent.
Right,
She was the original final girl. And so these modern characters, Thaisa Farmiga's crew, the Scooby Gang, are kind of, like, confused initially because these people won't break character.
Right.
They are their character. So it is fun. It sort of pulls back as this, like, meta horror movie. Mostly it's a comedy in the structure of a horror movie, and that's kind of fun to watch it play through those tropes. Let's see. It turns out the original drafts of the script were darker, and I imagine it would probably come out more like Cabin in the Woods in terms of, like, a hard R movie.
Okay.
But between selling the idea, different studios wanted to do different things, and the story was eventually shaped to be a PG-13 story. They lost a little bit of the gore and sort of bumped up a little more of the comedy, and I think it works. It was pretty effective. It's not...
So what was it coming out then? So when
PG-13.
It was PG-13.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's funny. So some of the characters being complete stereotypes.
Uh-huh.
I mentioned the, like, oversexed girl who's overly eager to take off clothing or dance. They recognize that character going into, like, sexy mode is going to invoke this slasher. Like, he shows up when you're being bad.
Right.
So they literally have to, like, strap her down and not, like, they put oven mitts on her hands she can't, like, take off pieces of clothing until they've set a trap. You know, it is very Scooby Gang, where they set up the traps and then they sort of let her go. And she does, like, a strip tease to pour some sugar on me.
Of course.
You know, 80s rock song. I don't remember which. But that was really funny. That setup was kind of great. That, like, once she goes off,
that's when he comes around.
That's where he comes out of the mist. Yeah.
Oh my god, he's coming.
Not yet, wait to move.
It also stars Aaliyah Shawkat, who is maybe from Arrested Development, and
maybe?
that is her name.
Shut up.
But yeah, no, she plays the hilarious best friend. She's really funny, and I don't know. I like seeing her whenever she pops up in things. It had a great ending that was consistent with the genre, and also, like, it left me really wanting to see a sequel.
Really?
Yeah, because it also, I mean, in the way that the Scream movies broaden the meta commentary and they're just like, well, that was the original. And in the sequel, you got to up the body count all these different, you know, the tropes sort of moving with the series.
Uh-huh.
And so it ends on a note of, like, what's going to happen in part two, because we're there now.
Right.
Roll credits.
Nice.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah, it was, I like this a lot. The Final Girls. I thought it was pretty funny. I guess for a PG-13 movie, it was, you know, risky enough.
What made you want to watch it?
You know what? I started watching it when I was editing the Alien episode.
Oh.
And then typically I'll watch just random stuff in with my peripheral vision, but this occupied, like, I had to stop what I was doing and finish watching that. And I, yeah, it was good enough that it you know, held my attention.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. So you got American Horror Story.
Yeah,
this
American
season.
Horror Story, which I thought, just because of some of the cast in Final Girls, I kind of thought Ryan Murphy was associated with it, but okay. I guess he's not.
No.
But it's some of the same kind of cast. So on the Ryan Murphy then train, I'm watching American Horror Story right now, Hotel, mm-hmm. which everyone's shitting on and everyone's hating it. But me, I think, like, am I on crazy pills? I'm not sure because I really, really like it.
The more you talked about it, the more guilty I felt for missing it so far. So we're, what, 5-6 episodes in?
Maybe 5 or 6 episodes. Okay. Yeah. I'm completely caught up on it. I don't miss it. I never miss it because I think it's, like, really, really great. This year it takes place in this Art Deco or Beaux-Art kind of hotel. And it was built by a man in this story called J.P. March, who is kind of a parallel to a character like H.H. Holmes.
Who's regarded as like the first American serial killer.
The first American serial killer, whose real name was actually like Herman Webster Mudgett, which is like the worst name. I understand like two things, why he changed it and why he became a serial killer.
Right. Well, he was one of these people who was like a sociopath through and through. So he was on the lam. He changed his name. He got married. He left people. He killed people.
But you know what? He was really, I mean, they think he was killing ahead before he got into Chicago. But he wasn't really killing for that long. He didn't arrive in Chicago until 1886, and he's killed in 1896. So he has a really short run of killing.
But isn't it kind of assumed that in these sort of previous lives that he had where he was essentially like stealing from people and was like everything he could do to not get a job?
Yeah. Oh, no. Which is weird, too, because, again, he actually came from a very wealthy family, New England family. So there's no reason for him to. He loved insurance fraud, which I guess late 1800s was like the time for insurance.
They would
fraud.
Just take you at your word.
Yeah. And everyone was doing this. Like, this was the common way to make money. And so he enlisted the help of some lackeys kind of into getting this insurance fraud business kind of going. He arrives in Chicago, because he always wanted to be a doctor. This is H.H. Holmes, not J.P. March here. Because he always wanted to be a doctor, which they even say, as a kid, he kind of performed surgeries on pets or
that's a
animals
real
and things.
Nice way to put that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So he becomes a pharmacist, and that's what brings him to Chicago. And he inherits this pharmacy because the original owner goes missing. And that's what kind of keeps him in Chicago. Then he builds the papers at the time were calling the Murder Castle, Chicago's Murder Castle.
Right, right. And he had it built by a number of different people.
Yes.
And
he would keep firing the people.
So
no
one
knew
the previous structure that they were building on. So, like, he had, like, murder rooms and torture rooms.
And he had a series of chutes and different things like different rooms that could have allow gas to get in. So he would gas people.
What? That I didn't know.
Yeah, he had the chutes led down to the incinerator, but they didn't go straight into an incinerator. So he had the option once throwing a body down the chute to either experiment, which was something he really liked to do, or just go ahead and burn them.
He had a column A, column B.
Exactly, exactly. Like, save this one for later. Let's throw this away now. That's where it comes in with the character J.P. March and the American Horror Story Hotel. This hotel is set up very similar in that there's chutes, there's tons of rooms with murder and mayhem and everything. You don't find out about J.P. March until like later on, a few episodes in. Mm-hmm. you know, there's this kind of rapey ghost guy that walks around.
It is American Horror Story after
exactly. all. Exactly. It's very sexual this season. It's like really, really sexual. But what I'm enjoying about it is Mare Winningham, to me, she shows up always in TV shows and movies, and then she like dies immediately. This is just like Mare Winningham's
special
thing.
Guest star this one episode.
Exactly. And so it's always great to see her for the small amount of time we get to see her. But in this, she so far hasn't died for real. She's a ghost.
Okay.
And I'm not giving anything
tough
away.
Tough to kill.
Yeah, exactly. and she talks in this really old-timey style of talking and acting. And that's what I'm like loving about this season. Her and J.P. March, who's Evan Peters is J.P. March in this. Okay. They talk in a way that's like Universal or Hammer old-timey style of speaking.
Okay, like they're in a gothic film?
Yeah, but with kind of, it's got this really, what do I want to say? It's like, it's got this
like
really,
theatrical, like a play?
It is. It's very theatrical. It's got a very specific cadence to the way they both speak, and they're okay. completely sticking to it. And everything, when J.P. March talks, everything is very, Peter Cushing is very exposition, like, this is what I'm gonna tell you about my great plan. And there's this very specific cadence that's really in line with Peter Cushing, the way that they speak. And so the two of them together, they're my favorite thing ever. But they have to interact with other characters, other people, and the other characters and the other people aren't in the same trope that they are in.
Yeah, we talked about this and how it seems like there's a disconnect between the people who say, you know, are giving this bad reviews mm-hmm. and may not be appreciating the sort of layered genres
right,
that are taking place all at the same time. I mean, yeah. I get that it could be jarring that like everyone's in a different movie.
Yeah, it is. It's exactly like that. But that's what I love. It's like you have Gaga and Matt Bomer and they're straight out of The Hunger. You know, I mean, the acting style, everything. I mean, to the fact that when they're introduced, you actually hear Bauhaus, Bela Lugosi's Dead is what's playing. And so you go, oh, okay, all right, this is straight out of The Hunger. And so even like Gaga has to interact with these Hammer film people or these Universal kind of film people. And then now Angela Bassett has shown up and she's right out of a blaxploitation movie. And that's her style and she sticks with it. So she, you know, speaks with Matt Bomer and she's speaking in her style and Matt Bomer is still in The Hunger style. It's very, I understand why people think it's uneven because it is a very uneven show.
Right.
And the ones that are doing it well are doing it really well. But then there's so much responsibility on Wes Bentley. That was a mistake on Ryan Murphy's part. Right now is what I would say, watching the show right now, because I can't figure out where he's supposed to be from. I thought he was like a Hitchcock guy first.
Okay.
He's like a family man with a wife and a kid and a missing child. I don't know. I thought, and he wears suits and he looks very Hitchcocky. So I thought maybe that's who he was, but I'm not getting it. So I don't know yet. I'll have to come back on that. But I'm loving Mare Winningham for sure. She's like stealing the show right now.
Yeah. I'm excited to check it out. And I don't know. It's kind of impressive that something like this exists, that something like this, I mean, it's not ABC, NBC, CBS, but it's a, you know, FX is kicking ass. And this is a show like, exclusively for like horror completists.
Oh yeah, and this is one of the like this season. My parents watch it.
Okay.
And my dad, he was ahead of me at the very beginning. I didn't start on the first week, and my dad's like, "Have you seen it yet? Have you seen it yet? Will you please watch it? I need to talk about it." He's like, "It's really weird." And in that first episode, you're just like, "I couldn't believe it was on regular TV." I mean, I know that FX is cable. But I couldn't believe it wasn't on a premium channel.
Right, right.
Like, wow, graphic sex and weird sex.
Well, you sold me. I'm in.
It's weird. But to me, like right now, I'm loving it. I think it's really cool. I understand that Wes Bentley's not so great. And I think people complain about the acting.
Mm.
And I think mostly they're complaining about him because there's no place for him. And maybe it's just not yet. There's no place for him yet.
So. That'll be interesting if he. I don't know. I don't have strong opinions about Wes Bentley. I don't know.
I've never really seen him. Freak Show last year, and he just shit up the place.
I've not seen him stretch exactly.
No.
He's just kind of like, all right. Well, you're a brooding guy who gave up the video camera and the plastic bag.
Exactly.
Floating.
It's like you're a very handsome, like generically like black Irish looking guy, and you're very, with your cheekbones, handsome fella, but.
I was going to say, this conversation, the idea of something that is such a pure homage, and in this case to a number of different genres, we talked about how I thought Crimson Peak was an impressive feat that it got made.
Mm-hmm. I remember you loved it.
As specific as it was. I did. And that said, the people walking out of the theater with me, right behind me, within earshot, were complaining about how bad the acting was. And I was like, it was a gothic horror movie. It wasn't...
This is the style.
That's how it's made.
That's how I feel like, yeah, when I read some of these, like, and people who I even like and usually agree with their opinions on things, when they start, like, shitting on it, I'm like, but you just don't get it. And then you like get defensive, even though it's like not even my creation, but I'm like a little defensive about it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, you feel like it's not getting a fair judgment.
Right.
Yeah. It's not considering the context.
Because I'm sure someone's, you know, listening and saying, oh no, Wes Bentley is clearly doing this. And they're saying to me, like, you don't get Wes Bentley.
Right.
And
right.
I'm sure I don't, but I'm unclear on what he's supposed to be.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I would give you the benefit of the doubt that it sounds like it's down to him. It's been a bittersweet thing that I've kind of run out of space for graphic novels, and so I've started buying them on my Kindle, and that is like buying shit with a credit card. It doesn't feel like real money.
It's very being dangerous. Spent.
So I've bought a lot of things in a short period of time. A couple months ago, we went over Scott Snyder's Witches, and that graphic novel is the collection of the first six episodes. It's like a podcast.
No. Yeah, right.
First six issues. And, you know, we loved all over it. And it was really good writing, beautiful artwork, just this impressive piece of art. And I talked about really enjoying his writing and sort of digging in and recognizing that, like, he's written a ton of stuff of, like, superheroes and tights, but also horror stuff. And that's what I've been nerding out over. So I'll start off with his book, Severed. And it's story by Scott Snyder and Scott Tuft, and art by Attila Futaki.
Oh, and so he always uses a different artist, or?
Because he does a lot of, like, overlapping work, he does work with different people at different times.
Okay.
With the Batman stuff, he's been working with Greg Capullo specifically, and that's, I don't know, because Batman's not horror, we'll kind of leave it out. I'll just say that the Court of Owls series was impressive. It's really cool to watch someone take the Batman mythos and still dig into it and tell new stories. But yes, on to the horror stuff.
Yeah, we weren't talking about Batman.
I can't help myself. So the story Severed is a Great Depression era story about an orphan crossing the country looking for his dad.
Okay.
All he has is a photograph and a letter. His dad was a musician. If you're ever in Chicago, look me up at this theater. That's all this kid knows. He was raised by a foster mom who's sweet enough, but this kid kind of wants answers to bigger questions that she can't solve. Mm-hmm. So it's a road story, but paralleled by, like, there is a proper demon of a monster who, because this is the 20s and there is no grid.
Right.
We were talking about H.H. Holmes getting away with insurance fraud. And in the 20s, this guy would show up to orphanages with, you know, mocked up credentials and say, like, I work for General Electric and I'm looking for an apprentice. And they're like, that would be great. Tommy here would love to accompany you. He takes his kid to an abandoned house and fucking eats him.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So this guy, you know, he is stealing the identity of, like, traveling salesmen.
Sure.
And eating orphans. It's a pretty good life if you can swing it.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's a proper villain.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when our main character, Orphan, comes into the sights of this guy, he's just like, oh, I'm going to eat him. And pursues him. And so it becomes this thing where, like, the orphan kid doesn't fully know what he's dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
All, you know, and this guy is, like, being overly friendly. He's essentially the 1920s version of, like, hey, kid, you want some candy? Like,
right,
but
right.
Just an extended version of that. And, yeah, it so the story is tragic and compelling and terrifying at times, and it's really, really cool. And I really like the 1920s as a setting. I guess it's actually pre-Depression, but it's like Dust Bowl era. Mm-hmm. You know, we weren't doing all that great, even if it was before the Great Depression. But yeah, so that one was Severed, and I would recommend that to people to check out. It is both a terrifically written story and also gorgeous. It's very painterly, this mm-hmm. particular book. The next one I'm not fully done with, but I'm excited enough to want to talk about it on the podcast.
Okay, all right. This half one's, information's good.
This one's called The Wake, and it's by Scott Snyder and Sean Murphy. This one combines a couple of interesting ideas that relate to the myth of mermaids.
Okay.
And I love it because it deals with evolutionary biology and this sort of like theorizing what might have happened 5 billion years ago.
Okay.
And so the idea that mermaids might be an extension of the aquatic ape theory, and the idea that, like, we as mammals, there's, you know, marked differences between us and bonobo apes, who are our nearest, you know, nearest brother. And the theory supposes that we spent more and more time in water, and this story supposes that we branched off, and some of us never left the water. And
fair
over
enough.
5 billion years.
Who doesn't like to swim?
I love it. You don't.
Well,
do you
I don't know how to swim, but I like to be in a pool.
Oh, okay.
Got it's different.
And hot tubs.
I'm your hot tub mermaid. That's how I evolved.
So a brief synopsis for this one. Marine biologist Lee Archer is approached by the Department of Homeland Security to help identify a potential threat. In the depths of the Arctic Circle, an ancient species has been discovered. But when things go horribly wrong, as they inevitably do,
always,
their scientific safe haven will turn into a house of horrors at the bottom of the ocean. So I'm about halfway done with it, but I love it to death. The art is very different from, you know, even the other collaborations that Scott Snyder's had. But, you know, and I still maintain that I'm like an unwarranted art snob when it comes to graphic novel. Sure. I have a hard time getting through a book if it's not very pretty to look at.
Fair enough.
But yeah, it mostly carries because Scott Snyder is an outstanding writer. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I've been catching up with volumes of The Walking Dead graphic novel.
Which I enjoy because I don't read, but then you tell me the story, and then it's like I've read it. It's like a Darren book on tape. And I hate to admit it, but like I know some of the things that happen because I read fanfic.
You read Walking Dead fanfic?
Yeah, I read Walking Dead fanfic.
What do they call the matching of the?
Well, there's Carol with the Y. That's Carol and Daryl.
Okay, but
I mean, it's
what
TV
do you call
show
the term?
Crosses over with the comic book a lot of times in fanfic, just so you know.
Okay, but what do you call?
Like slash. There's
is that
there's
what it
definitely
is?
Like Daryl and Rick slash, but I don't really read that because I don't.
I'm trying to think. Is there no what's the term for?
Ask me about fanfic. I'll tell you.
For coupling characters.
Oh, like a ship?
Yes. Shipping.
Yeah, ship. So like, well, I read lots of different kinds. So like, but a lot of times I'm reading one with an original character that goes, it stays really close to, except for Daryl's put into it, but it sticks really close to the comic
the graphic
books.
Novel more
yeah.
than the show.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you're kind of like, when you were explaining Hilltop to me, I was like, oh, I've read about that.
The orgies at Hilltop.
It's mostly story and like then like every like six chapters smut.
It's like Pride and Prejudice and zombies. It's like it's story, 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 zombies, story, 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 orgy.
There's not actually orgies in the one that I'm reading.
Okay, threesomes, what have you. So yeah, so I have been catching up. I initially dropped out a couple months back when they finished up the Negan saga. Mm-hmm. And that was, for a fan who's read the collection up to that point, it was exhausting. Mm-hmm. It was emotionally draining. It's so weird to think that a graphic novel leaves me feeling this way, but like when major characters are killed off and you've been with them for, you know, the length of time you've been reading the stories, yeah, man, that hurts. That hurts a lot.
When they killed Dobby in Harry Potter,
yeah,
I was inconsolable. Aww. I couldn't even read through all the tears in my eyes. So
those
I totally
pages
understand.
Have like waterlogged.
Yeah, I mean, like I couldn't even continue reading. It was like so. I definitely understand about reading and crying.
Harry Potter is my friend.
I know. There's no reason.
So yeah, so when they announced that Jeffrey Dean Morgan was cast as Negan for season 6, I thought, all right, it's
because
time,
I really
it's time
wanted
Vinny
Jones.
In.
All I wanted in life was for that to be Vinny Jones.
Yeah, although he would have inexplicably just been an Englishman, and Vinny Jones actually act.
No,
I mean,
but he doesn't need to
a
act.
A version of himself. Right, but I would have a very hard time taking seriously. And it's funny that, like, Rick, I can't think of the actor who plays Rick.
Andrew Lincoln.
So Andrew Lincoln, being an Englishman, has to do a sort of loose Georgia accent.
Right. Maggie, too.
But I'm saying if Vinnie Jones was an Englishman amongst these Americans, I think it would knock some of the, like, the impact of this ultimate badass.
He would be just like a fancier badass.
Well, so that's one of the things that the character of Negan speaks almost exclusively in profanity.
Right.
And how AMC, they've kind of already...
They're doing a good job with Abraham.
Abraham,
and
I was
going to
say.
And he's hilarious. The things he says are really funny.
Right, because no human being speaks that way.
Right, right. Like, so the censorship actually is working in their favor in that way.
It's as if, like, that is how he would talk with children around.
Yeah. I don't know. Would I say mother dick in front of a child? I'm probably. I don't watch my mouth around children, so...
So going back to the graphic novel, Robert Kirkman and Charlie Adler have continued, like, I felt there was a point with the Negan stuff where they were just turning the knife, and that's why, you know, it was exhausting over time, but the stories they've grown to tell later in the series about, like, these communities thriving and sort of, you know, it's almost like the re-evolution of man, where now they've had to reintroduce agriculture. And you've got these communities sort of working together and trying to make do, and then you introduce even creepier elements from outside. I won't go into the details, and I would actually ask if the listener is a fan of the show, do yourself the favor, check out the graphic novels. It is
or have
different
Darren
enough.
Tell you about it.
I will do some audiobooks. but yeah, the graphic novels are different enough that they're engaging on a different level. And when the books hit their stride, yeah, it's something else. Like, you are along for the ride with these characters, and their heartbreaks are your heartbreaks, and their successes are yours. It's really, it's great. I can't say enough good things about the graphic novel, but it is interesting that, like, you can only go so dark in the graphic novel. And I mean, you kind of imagine that the series is going to end when Rick Grime ends.
Right.
And I'll say that even healthy as he is, where I am in volume 24, he is broken and fucked up. Like,
well,
it is.
Yeah.
It's an unforgiving life he's led. And, like, he is walking with a limp and missing a hand. And yeah, that dude's been through a lot.
Yeah, it's a hard life. Hard life being Rick Grimes.
It'll be interesting how long the show carries on and just how much we're expected to bear for Rick, because they've spared him the hand going missing.
Right, right.
And that was one of the darkest moments in terms of the graphic novel and the governor, and they've softened that way too much for my liking.
Right. I hated that governor bullshit. So I'm hoping with Negan, it becomes,
I think they'll go that dark. And there are videos leaked online that suggest that, yeah, it's going to get ugly.
Yeah, I'm worried about that leaked video there.
Yeah. But yeah, so far this season's been killing it. And we'll do an episode on The Walking Dead later on once this half season is up. But yeah, that's it for this episode of Lunch Hour Reviews. Make sure to check us out on Facebook and Twitter. We are at Rance Macabre. And we're also on Stitcher. I'm going to make a small note that, you know, we're obviously a free podcast. We're not asking for money, but we are going to ask you to swing by iTunes and hit subscribe. And please give us a review there. It goes a long way in helping us spread the podcast. And frankly, it doesn't take much in terms, you could just give us the stars and move on with your day.
Yeah.
But yeah, recommend us to a friend. And on our website, The Rance Macabre, we have regular updates, and we're also going to have YouTube videos that we're working on. By the time this podcast comes out, they will be available. So we're going to be on our own YouTube channel and have, you know, hopefully regular updates with videos, and we try and write funny stuff for you guys. So check us out there.
And be sure to subscribe, because we're sometimes putting out extra episodes at the end of the week, not just on Mondays. So you can get that if you didn't know to watch for it. You've been listening to The Rants Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rants Macabre, contact Ken at fangoria.com.
This is me, Darren, signing off.
And this is me, thanks.